We'll move into our series. We're doing a series on King David, as you saw in the video. We talked for a couple of weeks. First of all, that God has a position for everyone, a position of influence in the world. And last week, we talked about part of the path to that, the difficult path in order to get there. If you missed the message, you can hear them online. The audio is available online. You can also get it via podcast. Today, we're talking about the problem. Seems that nothing good comes easy. There is a YouVersion for this, a YouVersion event on the Bible app. If you have any smart device, you can download the Bible app, and if you go to events, and there's a relevant Bible passage, but there's also application questions. Where do we go from here? How do I live this out day to day? And if we have time at the end, we'll deal with text messages. My number's on the screen. If you have a comment or question relevant to the message today, then we'll try to answer those. Okay, I want to start with a story, something of a story. There's a lot of technical details, but this is a true story. Some years ago, sometime in the last century, there was an energy generation plant, and they had a minor problem in the plant. There was a minor malfunction in a secondary cooling circuit that caused the temperature in the generator in the coolant to rise. But there's safety features. Right? So when the temperature went up, there was a shutoff. It caused the generator to shut down automatically. That took up all of about a second. And in order to keep stuff from being damaged, within seconds of the shutdown, there was an operator that was signaled to turn on a relief valve on the cooling system, and it opened as it was supposed to, and the water went in to cool it, and it was supposed to stay open for 10 seconds and then automatically close. Okay? But it didn't automatically close. It stayed open. Now, the instrument showed that the relief valve was closed because the instrument showed that a signal had been sent to close it, but there was no signal that actually showed where the relief valve was. So all they knew was that the signal had been sent to close it, but the thing was stuck open. Everybody thought the valve was closed. Everything was running the way it was. So the actual position was not measured. So, oblivious to the workers at the plant, the water was rushing through this, and it was getting heated up, and the water was turning into steam, and then the tank that was feeding water was emptying out and automatically being replenished. So all the operators, they saw that water kept on rushing into the cooling tank, and they thought this thing is being flooded with water. So they reduced the water replacement, not knowing that all the... because they thought the system was filling up with water. They didn't know that the water was escaping through this valve. So, I mean, there were a couple of gauges that should have been checked, and after the fact, one of the guys said, you know, he checked one of them, didn't check the other one. But instead of the space being flooded with water, which they thought, it was actually running dry because this valve was stuck open. And the thing was getting hotter and hotter, and the steam actually caused the cooling pumps to vibrate, which is causing vibration to happen, and it could have damaged the pumps and made them unusable, so the operators shut down the pumps as the thing is getting hotter and hotter. And it is heating the core of the power plant. Now, it doesn't sound like that big of a deal. The detail I haven't told you, this power plant was a nuclear reactor, and it ended up causing this, they had to evacuate thousands and thousands of people. It released a cloud of nuclear gas. And this happened in 1977, less than 500 kilometers from here. It's called the Three Mile Island disaster. And you think about this, the government calling for evacuation, and everyone going, like, how could this possibly happen? You know how it happens? One small step at a time. One thing measuring the wrong thing. Somebody not looking at the right dial. Step by step by step, and all of a sudden you have disaster. That's what I want to talk about today, disaster. We're looking at 2 Samuel 11 and 12, two full chapters. I've been going kind of verse by verse. This story is way too long to do that. So I'm going to do some kind of summary and looking at specific passages. And we're talking about David. We've talked about how David, God has promised him this position of influence. He's going to be the new king. And last week we talked about the right path to get there, and we're doing a huge jump ahead because now we're talking about an episode in which he's already king. So David has come to the place that God has ordained for him to be in that position of influence. And here's where things start going wrong. The previous sermon series we did, the one that like went really long on Genesis, I don't know if you remember that. There was one message in there called grasping, which was about the woman in the garden taking the fruit that sets everything wrong. And there's a pattern in there where she sees the fruit, she desires the fruit, takes it, and eats it. Three-part pattern. She sees it, she takes it, she eats it. And I'm going to show you this exact pattern is happening here in the story of David, okay? So the first thing that happens is David sees something. 2 Samuel chapter 11, I'm reading what's this called? The New Living Translation. We sell these for a really good price if you want one at the information desk. Otherwise, you could read on a... I can see everybody looking down at their text. You can get it on your phone as well. So, 11 verse 1. In the spring of the year, when kings normally go out to war, David sent Joab, and the Israelite, Joab is his general, to the Israelite army to fight the Ammonites. They destroyed the Ammonite army and laid siege to the city of Rabbah. However, David stayed behind in Jerusalem. Late one afternoon, after his midday rest, David got out of bed and was walking on the roof of the palace. As he looked out over the city, he noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. David sees something. Here's where the problem is. The very first verse is, in the spring of the year, when kings normally go out to war, David had a job, David had a task and a responsibility. You lead your army to war. And David took his eyes off the target. He disengaged from his mission. He put himself in a position of complacency. You know, I've had a long road for the past 20 years, and I'm going to take it easy. And when you disengage from God's purpose for you, it puts you in a place that makes you vulnerable to temptation. 2 Corinthians 10:12 says, if you think you are standing strong, be careful not to fall. When you think everything's going good and you become less attentive to what's going on, all of a sudden you see something that distracts you from God's purpose. David starts by seeing. Second thing, take. 2 Samuel 11, next verse 3. He sent someone to find out who she was, and he was told she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Last week I talked about David was destined to be king, and there was a problem because there already was a king. The position was already occupied. David wants this woman, but she already has a husband. That's a problem. He sent someone to find out who she was. Then David sent messengers to get her, and when she came to the palace, he slept with her. She had just completed the purification rites after having her menstrual period. Then she returned home. David was supposed to be a new kind of king. The king was Saul. Saul was a power-hungry maniac. And David was supposed to be the man who's after God's heart, the guy who does things, who doesn't grasp for power, he doesn't grasp to take things that he wants. He was supposed to be fulfilling God's mission. And all of a sudden, David himself becomes the power wielder. I don't know if you caught this, but the verb that's attached to him a few times is he sends. He sends for her. And you're going to see that if read the rest of the chapter at home. He's sending messengers all the time. People, do my bidding. And all of a sudden, he's acting like Saul. And how could this be? David forgot something. This is what he forgot. It's something that all of us can easily forget. God has a position of influence for you in the world. This is what he forgot. The position's not for you. He doesn't have a position for you for you. He has a position for you for the world. David's position as king was not for him to benefit from, although we do benefit when God puts us in a position of influence, but it's not for us primarily, it's for the world. And all of a sudden, he's sitting in his palace, not doing what he's supposed to do, and he finds himself in a position of entitlement. You know what? I want, I'm going to take. And then eat. I mean, all kinds of euphemisms there that I'm not going to touch at all. But David, he basically takes what doesn't belong to him. And what happens, and this is where I'm going to kind of encourage you to read the text at home. We can't go verse by verse. But the wrongdoing, like it always does, it compounds itself. Because the first thing that happens after this is she gets pregnant, and David thinks, uh-oh, now there's a problem. David starts with looking, taking, and eating, and he steps into the role of adulterer. And uh-oh, something's wrong. And so what he does is he sends for her husband, say, you know, come on back and spend some time near the palace and take a break from the fighting. But he's manipulating now. He's deceiving because he wants this guy to go home and, you know, spend time with his wife, right? As somebody said, you know, do the marriage thing. So he's setting up the guy, he's setting up her husband. And some scholars think that the husband was really naive and faithful to David, and he refuses to go home. How can I go home to my wife and enjoy life when all the other soldiers are out there? But other people think that he kind of had a clue what was going on. Like, if David sends for this woman, it's not like nobody sees her go to the palace. So maybe somebody whispered in this guy's ear and go, you know, there's something fishy going on here. So he says, I'm not going home. And so David's adultery turns into manipulation, and the manipulation doesn't work, and David says, what am I going to do about this? And he manipulates even further to have this guy sent back to the battlefield and exposed at the front line where he's killed. David doesn't kill him, just kind of arranges to have him killed. So his adultery turns into manipulation. His manipulation becomes murder. He uses his own enemies to kill one of his friends. There's a chapter in Samuel and in Chronicles, I think, it lists all of David's heroes. And he's got a list of all these heroes. And among his top 30 heroes is Uriah the Hittite, one of his best men. And David arranges to have him murdered to cover his own wrongdoing. This is the man after God's heart. When you get home, read the rest of the chapter. 12 verse 1, so the Lord sent Nathan the prophet to tell David this story. God says Nathan, you remember from two messages ago, a prophet is somebody who speaks for God and many times challenges authority. Two messages ago, we talked about how Samuel the prophet was going to anoint and specifically choose David to be king instead of Saul, and this was dangerous. It's dangerous to challenge authority when authority abuses power. Imagine being Nathan. God comes and says, I want you to tell David's story because David did something really wrong. Would you go? So Nathan is he tries to be subtle. Here he is speaking truth to power. David has started acting like his predecessor Saul. And he tells him this pointed story where he says, you know, there was a rich man who had everything he wanted. And there was a poor man who had one little lamb, which was like a daughter to him. I don't know if you caught this, but the very first description we have of this woman, Bathsheba, is that she is somebody's daughter. Okay, that's not an accident. Who is this woman? Bathsheba, daughter of. So this person has one little lamb that's like a daughter to him. And the rich man says, somebody's coming to visit. I need to provide a meal. And he takes that one lamb instead of everything that he has. And David hears the story, and he reacts very strongly. He says, this is not right. That person must be punished. And then David turns around and says, no, this is you I'm talking about. That would be a very scary thing to be Nathan in that situation. I think it might be scary for David once he recognized what was going on. Nathan says, this is what the Lord says. Because of what you have done, I will cause your own household to rebel against you. I will give your wives to another man before your eyes, and he will go to bed with them in public view. You did it secretly, but I will make this happen to you in the sight of all Israel. Now, here's what David does, and here's where we see, once again, a contrast between David and Saul. Verse 13, David confessed to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. Now, he didn't say I've sinned against Bathsheba or Uriah, her husband. He says, I've sinned against the Lord. I've compromised the very position God has brought me in. And I saw this for the very first time ever. Nathan replied, yes, but the Lord has forgiven you, and you won't die for this sin. Before David even responds, God says, I have forgiven you. Sometimes I think what we do is we do something wrong, and we hide from God because we fear him. And God says, I have forgiven you. Now, consequences still happen. He says, nevertheless, because you have shown utter contempt for the Lord by doing this, your child will die. The consequence doesn't go in, but God has forgiven. In fact, David's failure leads to all kinds of catastrophe, personal and for the nation, because I think what happens is he sees himself as somewhat disqualified, and when his own kids start acting up and doing stuff that's even worse, he fails to deal with it. And it turns into a huge mess. But the difference here between him and Saul is when Saul gets caught doing wrong, he justifies himself. He defends himself. He constantly says, "I don't have any other choice to do this." The king, who is power hungry, who's a tyrant, he's a maniac, and Samuel comes and says, "You did this wrong." "No, I didn't have a choice." You ever find yourself saying, "I didn't have a choice," but you know you did? "I don't have a choice." And David says, "I did something wrong," and he confesses. And verse 26, David comforted Bathsheba, his wife. 26. Meanwhile, Joab was fighting against Rabbah, the capital of Ammon, and he captured the royal fortifications. Joab sent messengers to tell David, "I fought against Rabbah and captured his water supply. Now bring the rest of the army and capture the city, otherwise I will capture it and get credit for the victory." So David gathered the rest of the army and went to Rabbah, fought against and captured it. He goes back to the mission. He jumps back into relationship with God, and he jumps back into mission. Now, as we've been going through the series, I've been kind of peppering the story with Psalms, like that kind of illustrate where David is. And you may be thinking, well, where are the Psalms? Why aren't you reading the Psalms? I would suspect that David didn't stop writing during this time, okay? I can imagine him writing songs about Bathsheba as he's watching her bathe. And if he did, those were not included. And I can understand why. I was thinking of writing like a little sample version, but it would probably go, you look at Song of Solomon, maybe some of the descriptions there may not be appropriate for a Sunday morning. But what happens is if he did write, we don't have them, but he did write a psalm after the fact. And I'm going to read portions of Psalm 51, which there's a very old tradition that this is a psalm that he wrote about this very, very event. Psalm 51, 1-4 says, "Have mercy on me, O God, because of your unfailing love. Because of your great compassion, blot out the stain of my sins. Wash me clean from my guilt. Purify me from my sin. For I recognize my rebellion. It haunts me day and night. Against you and you alone have I sinned. I have done what is evil in your sight. You will be proved right in what you say, and your judgment against me is just." You can sense that's from the heart. Later in the same psalm, verse 10-11, "Create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a loyal spirit within me. Do not banish me from your presence, and don't take your Holy Spirit from me." David is described to Samuel by God, "I'm looking for somebody who is a man after my own heart." And this was David's primary concern, his relationship with God. Same chapter, verse 16 to 17, "You do not desire a sacrifice, or I would offer one. You do not want a burnt offering. The sacrifice you desire is a broken spirit. You will not reject a broken and repentant heart, O God." Again, the contrast with Saul, who's constantly defending himself. "I had no choice." And David says, "My number one priority is my relationship with God." One last, Psalm 32, verses 1 and 2. "Oh, what joy for those whose disobedience is forgiven, whose sin is put out of sight. Yes, what joy for those whose record the Lord has cleared of guilt, whose lives are lived in complete honesty." Now, every one of us here today, without exception, is on either side of a bad decision. We're either facing one, or we've already made one. One of my bad decisions was leaving the thing turned on. Okay, so if you've already gone wrong, if you're like David, confronted with a bad decision in the past, what do you do about it? The first thing, recognize that your position that you are in is not for you. But our position also exposes us to the attack of the enemy. So when we become complacent, the enemy of humanity, the enemy of you, the enemy of God, that would undermine God's purpose, will attack you at your weak points. And we all have weak points. So you need to keep your eyes open and be aware. But here's what you do. The first thing is acknowledge error. Yes, I did wrong. Not self-defense. I didn't have any choice. We all know we have choice. I did wrong. The second thing is jump back into relationship with God. Like we read in Psalm 51. Create in me a clean heart. I want to pursue relationship with you. In fact, this doesn't just apply for those who are on the back end of a bad decision. Maybe you're facing temptation. You go, "I don't know what to do about it." Jump into relationship with God. Face away from Bathsheba and her bathing. And pursue God. Pursue that relationship with him. Turn your eyes away. And the third thing is get back on mission. Do what you're supposed to be doing. I suspect that there are, I find there's more of men than women. I think men are more likely to beat themselves up for being less than perfect. And so we end up with a church that is strongly supported by women who work and lead and all that. And the guys tend not to because they go, well, I face temptation, I've done wrong things. Yeah, but staying out of mission will keep you in that spot. Jump back into mission. There's also movements more among guys than women about accountability, you know. Let's make sure you don't do anything wrong. No, accountability should be, are you on mission? Because that keeps you in the right spot. And then if you're facing temptation, same thing. Get on mission. Get in. Do those things that God has called you to do in whatever position you're in. Now, you may be not even at that point where you have a relationship with God at all. And we talk about this every week, but I have to say it again. How do you do that? It's as simple as ABC. First, admit your need for God. Acknowledge your need for God. The purpose God has for you in the world cannot be done apart from him. And the second thing is believe that Jesus, through his death and resurrection, has made the way possible for you. And part of what that's about is because we skimmed over very quickly, but when wrongdoing happens, sacrifice is required. But Jesus is the ultimate sacrifice. Jesus is the one that completely covers all the wrong that we do. So I have to put my trust in him. I have to believe that way is made available because of his complete, the ultimate sacrifice. And then the C is commit to him. Commit your entire life to him. And that's the jumping on mission. Commit to that relationship. Commit to the mission. If this is something that you need to do today, fill out one of these connection cards and there's a checkbox that says, I have decided to become a follower of Jesus today. Give it to the information desk. Or you can even text me and say, I'm in with your name. Please put your name because it's hard to respond to a number. Well done, 416-721 or whatever. But don't delay on that. Jump into relationship with God. We have a few text messages and we have 2 minutes for four. Two. Is it right that David says he sinned against God alone? He has clearly wronged Bathsheba and Uriah. Should he not seek their forgiveness as well? Hard to seek Uriah's forgiveness because he's dead. I don't want to be too flippant about that because sometimes we wrong people and we can't do anything about it. They're gone. They're gone from our lives. We can't track them down. And ultimately, when we reconnect with God, he makes those things right. With Bathsheba, I mean, he ended up marrying her and had another child by her. She knew, so I would think he kind of would have to. How do you tell someone, God killed your son because of me? That's pretty rough. But I'm filling in blanks there. If someone starts off as a very strong Christian and later turns into a horrible person, will they still have a place in heaven? Wow. That's one of those hypothetical case studies that you go, okay, there's details that are there missing. Like, are you talking about somebody? Because sometimes people turn into a horrible person because that's all we see because of stuff that happened to them. Like, we don't know what's going on in their heart. And there's sometimes that people get soured and bitter and they defend themselves and justify themselves and they actually do turn their back on God. And I would say this. God doesn't let go of his own children lightly. So I don't know the answer for a single individual, but I know that God keeps pursuing and keeps pursuing and we have a role to play in the reaching out to those that have turned their back on him. In fact, somewhere in the New Testament, it says something like that love covers a multitude of sins, and we can be part of catching somebody before the end. And I think that's important. But I wouldn't make a general statement about something that I think might be more specific than I can. I find that when we do things wrong, we will look for that fault in someone else and take it out on them. Ooh, well, that's kind of perceptive. This is what I've experienced. I've experienced that when somebody struggles with an issue. Somebody struggles with a temptation. They are quicker to nose it in somebody else and call it out in somebody else. Not every time, but it happens. There was a guy that was coming to our community meal regularly, and we kind of had to talk to him because he was harassing some of the other clients, and he was like hammering them all the time about internet pornography. It's like you guys are bad looking at pornography. You got to stop doing that. Stop doing that. And there was like 3 or 4 weeks. It's kind of like this is not your job here. And he came up to me one time, about 4 weeks after that, and had a conversation with me. This guy's not here, okay, just so you know. And he said, you know, I've really been struggling with internet pornography. It's like, that's why you're yelling at everybody else. You need to be yelling at yourself. You know, I'm not saying that yelling at yourself works, okay? What works is pursuing God, accountability, get on mission, right? But the natural default when you struggle with something is to notice it in other people and call it out. And that's kind of dysfunctional. Women don't understand that very important point you just made about how men react to failure. They tend to judge men more than themselves or other women. I don't know that that's a complete perspective. So that might be your experience, that you are judged. I've just never really talked to every woman yet. So I don't know that that's the case. I know that, I know that the longer I'm married, the more my wife understands my heart. The more my wife understands how much I beat myself up over failure. So I'm not sure to what extent that's true. I find now that I've been married for 23 and almost 24 years, my wife beats me up a lot less than I beat myself up, right? She's my encouragement. So maybe there's some more perspective that could be there. An antidote, okay, so last text message. An antidote, set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. So this is a Jordan Peterson fan who's quoting Jordan Peterson. And I think there's something legitimate there. In one sense, it can be limiting because nobody's house is in perfect order. So David is king, and he shouldn't stop being king because his house is not in perfect order, because somebody's got to be king. But look around at your own relationships before you start criticizing other people's relationships. And I think there's something to that. But man, if I had to have my house in perfect order and my life in perfect order first, you wouldn't have a pastor here at Crossroads Church. Like that's just the way it is. So I understand the sentiment, but there's a balance there. We're going to move into prayer. I'm going to ask that you would stand, and we're going to close in prayer. Every single one of us today is on either side of a bad decision, whether you're facing temptation for something, we all face temptation for something, or whether you've already made a bad decision and you're running from God because you know that God's standards are higher. Run back to him because you have been forgiven, as Nathan said to David. God has forgiven you. You go, well, what about the consequences? Well, deal with the consequences hand in hand with God, not on your own. Run back to God, get back on mission. So that's the prayer focus today. I know there's a lot of people here that need to do that. Take advantage of the prayer time. Kids, they're going to be taken care of for another 15 minutes in the kids' programs. You got time. Spend time here in prayer. Run back to God. Commit yourself back to him. You can pray with your small group, with family, with friends. You don't have to just do it all on your own. In fact, I recommend praying with other people. It works. And let me pray for you. Father, I know that we all face temptation, and some of us feel really beaten up because of decisions we've made, because of actions we've taken. And some of us here may need to ask forgiveness from somebody. But ultimately, we need to get ourselves right with you. I thank you for the forgiveness that you already offer.
I thank you that Jesus is willing to go to his death in order to extend that forgiveness. That when we can't make things right, you make things right. Father, help us not to run from you, but to run to you. Help us to keep our eyes on you. Help us to turn from things that we know lead us astray. Help us to be effective followers of Jesus in the world that are unmarred, unscarred by our own self-destructive nature. And Lord, we acknowledge that you can take bad things and make something good out of them. And so we throw in with you. We go all in with you. We want to be people after your heart, like David was. Help us to live that out. In Jesus' name, amen.